Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future live or on demand. I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, the FlySAF air strike grounds flights and exposes deeper turbulence in South African aviation. A labor law revolt as 40 groups say proposed reforms will gut worker rights. Artificial intelligence shaping South African manufacturing, but will it mean profit or job loss? And from trash to training, can e-waste solve South Africa's youth job crisis? It's Tuesday, the 22nd of July. Now, you'll know that hundreds of passengers left stranded, confused, and I imagine also furious as FlySAF Air grounded more than two dozen flights yesterday after a surprise strike by pilots demanding a wage hike of around 10%. Now, the airline, which carries the bulk of South Africa's domestic passengers, says the demands are far steeper once benefits are factored in. That has sparked a standoff that's already seen around 30% of weekly flights cut. Mediation, I understand, is to begin, but with school holidays ending and business travel starting to pick up again, if things continue, the fallout could be severe. So I want to talk now to Guy Leach, aviation analyst. He's also the editor of SA Flyer magazine and one of the country's most respected commentators in this respect. So, Guy, first of all, how serious is the strike for domestic aviation? Was it a shock or had tensions been building for some time, in your opinion?
Yeah, hi, Jeremy. Well, it's both a shock in terms of its impact on domestic aviation, but it's no surprise because tensions have been building for ages. The industrial relations process that led to this point has taken 6 months at least, but in fact, tensions have been simmering for a lot longer than that, particularly about the sort of other background issue, which is the roster.
What does it say, Guy, about industrial relations with inside the carrier, do you think?
Yes, a very interesting question because it's hard to pin it down. My sense of it, though, is that actually this is a big showdown that the airline management have put a price on. They've said, okay, we're prepared to spend, look, I've no idea what that price means. We're prepared to lose 50 million or even 100 million. I should imagine those are the sort of numbers they're talking about. For the sake of drawing a line in the sand and having the showdown with the pilots, because if they don't, I think they'll think it'll cost them that much more in the long run. And of course, as I've said, the thing about FlySAF Air is it's a low-cost carrier, so it survives by keeping its prices absolutely rock bottom, and that obviously means fighting with the pilots almost on a continual basis because the pilots are generally the second biggest expense for a low-cost carrier after fuel. And I think complete what I was saying in terms of your first question, the fact of the matter is that FlySAF Air is running, 66% or so of total domestic supply. And right now we're seeing a significant fall off, as much as 25% of fall off in the supply of seats from FlySAF. So the impact across the economy will be big.
Guy, let's talk about the roster in just a moment, because I spoke to a representative from the carrier a little earlier in the week, and the suggestion is that the roster issue is more important than the wage issue as far as they were concerned. But as far as money is concerned, FlySAF says pilots earn between 1.8 and 2 million rand a year, and that a 10% increase would push up total compensation by more than 20%. Help me understand this. Is that accurate and fair context?
No, I think there's too much spin going on in here, and quite frankly, none of these figures should have been put out for public consumption anyway, because they're incredibly hard to actually analyze and get to the bottom of. I mean, what is the airline talking about? Is this total cost of employment, total cost of the company? And it sounds a lot, but it's not, because the pilots, especially seasoned captains, can earn as much as three or four times and more often than not tax-free elsewhere in the world. So it is indeed a lot about lifestyle. SAF Air pilots don't want to have to leave South Africa to go and fly in the sand pit, you know, in the Middle East or in the Far East with Chinese airlines. And I think that it's worth bearing in mind that a lot of SAF Air's most senior pilots are formerly SAA pilots. So they've already had this rodeo, and they're still bruised from the loss of a year's income over the COVID business rescue process.
So what's the beef about the roster then?
Yeah, so the roster is very much about lifestyle. What happened was that FlySAF is a relatively young airline, just over 10 years old, and it had a relatively simple roster management system. A roster is an incredibly complex thing to run because obviously you've got to have various degrees of pilot availability. Obviously, the pilots are actually on duty for a specific amount of time, sitting behind the controls flying the airplanes. But then you've normally got two or three levels of standby. You've got standby with as little as half an hour. So the standby pilot needs to be available within half an hour to get onto the aircraft should one of the pilots suddenly turn up sick, for argument's sake. And then you've got one day standby, and then you've got two or three day standbys. And how you exactly manage that is incredibly tricky. So normally they give the pilots with the greatest seniority, simply those who've had the longest time at the airline, sort of first dibs at the roster in terms of bidding for certain slots and bidding for time off. And that obviously gives them time off to plan for family functions, their own birthdays, their children's birthdays, sports functions, and obviously family holidays. But the moment the roster gets messed around with, then the first thing that happens is that the security of being able to plan ahead goes. And that's what happened. What SAF Air did is they're shrugging their shoulders and they're saying, hey, but we recognized there was a problem and we upgraded the roster system about a year ago. The pilots are saying, yeah, fine, but you didn't buy the best version. And the version that you've bought doesn't have all the bells and whistles. Specifically, it needs very firm and agreed rules as to exactly what the processes of around, as I said, bidding are and so on. And those rules are not in place. So the pilots feel that they've been messed around as much as the last minute, literally sort of it's their well-planned weekend off. And now all of a sudden they've been called out. And, you know, what also happened was that pilots, just to get a little bit stuck into the detail here, normally would work on a 6-day on, 3-day off cycle. Then suddenly the roster became 5 days on and 2 days off. And that's a complete mess because that means that you've got a 7-day cycle. So everyone who gets the weekends off stays with the weekends off, and the others who didn't never did. These are some of the nuances that are going into this argument around the roster.
So, Guy, FlySAF Air has preemptively, if I understand this, cut around 30% of its schedule. But how long can it operate like this without starting to damage its market position?
Yeah, I just want to pick up on your 30%. That's correct. Yesterday, on Sunday evening, FlySAF Air was claiming that they managed the schedule intact on Monday. That didn't turn out to be the case. Then they said, okay, 8%. It turned out to be more like 12 to 14%. Now, they've admitted that the schedule is down about 25%. And obviously, if that continues, then it's going to be an absolute crisis. My take on the matter is that they are working the current pilots, the pilots who've stayed on, extra hard. By agreement, a lot of them are signed on for the extra hard work. But a lot of these pilots are going to run out of what we call flight and duty time this week because we're approaching the 100-hour end of the month limit anyway. And the agreements that they have with the pilots are only for a week. I think this is one of the main reasons management has agreed to come back to the table tomorrow to try and hammer this issue out. I also just want to correct a broad misapprehension in the rest of the media that 200 of the 300 pilots are on strike. That's not strictly correct. 200 of the 300 pilots were members of Solidarity, but my take is that only about two-thirds of the Solidarity members are actually on strike as well. So the airline has about 50% of its pilots available.
And Guy, just a quick one. The carrier controls around 60% of domestic seat capacity. The strike exposes a deeper problem. We are too reliant on one player, surely.
100%. You know, Lyft has been a very slow grower, if I may say so. We had a lot of hope that they would step into the gap created by the failure or the ending of Mango and Kalula in particular. But that hasn't been the case. So FlySAF Air grew enormously strongly. And this whole strike is pretty much a symptom of those growing pains. Yes, to some extent, we've seen Airlink and Semair step into the gap as well. And obviously, the slow resurrection of SAA helps supply. But no, you're 100% correct. The domestic airline industry is far too vulnerable and dependent upon FlySafe Air.
Guy Leach, thank you very much. As always, editor of SA Flyer magazine.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
More than 40 organizations, including trade unions, social movements and human rights groups, are preparing to picket outside in protest against the sweeping proposed changes to South Africa's labor laws. The protest, led by the Campaign to Scrap the Labor Law Amendment Bill, is accusing NEDLAC of holding secret talks and approving amendments they say will strip workers, particularly the most vulnerable, of key protection. Among the most contentious changes, the end of formal disciplinary hearings, relaxed rules around probationary dismissal, and the exclusion of small businesses from bargaining council wage agreements. Government and business leaders say the reforms are aimed at making the labour market more flexible to create jobs. Worker rights groups say it's a rollback to apartheid-era conditions. I'm in conversation now with Lebogang Panyeko, national organiser for the South African Federation of Trade Unions. Lebogang, welcome to you. Let's start with the strongest claim in your statement. You've called these proposals a return to apartheid-style dismissals. Isn't that an exaggeration? What exactly makes these changes so dangerous?
Thank you very much, Jeremy, and thank you very much for interviewing us. Actually, by saying these changes into the labor law will be taking us back to the apartheid days. What we mean, because during apartheid, you know very well, actually, in terms of labor law, was not actually easy for workers, especially the black workers, who did not have any rights. Employers in the dark days of apartheid were doing as they wish. So with the new sets of the new amendments on the labor law, it's going to take us back to the glory days of apartheid. We know workers, they fought tooth and nail for them to amend even the Labor Relations Act, which they are enjoying currently. So now these discussions actually, these amendments are going to take us back to apartheid.
Have you seen evidence at this point that this is already being abused in some sectors?
Look, Jeremy, the evidence that I can say about is that SAFTO is part of NEDLAC, and that's where these discussions and amendments actually are taking place. And unfortunately, SAFTO joins NEDLAC in 2023, when these negotiations and were underway since 2022. So when we entered the dialogue, we said, look, we are not going to agree. This must be taken to our members. This must be taken to the shop stewards for proper discussions, because a small team of bureaucrats sitting at NEDLAC can't decide the future of millions and millions of workers. For an example, you have seen from our statement, when we are saying small business will easily actually dismiss workers without a formal hearing. Who is a small business? Because even a big corporate can say, no, I'm a small business, I'm entitled, and then according to the law, then this is that. So, yeah, that's why we're fighting.
One of the points that you make is that formal disciplinary hearings will effectively be scrapped, but employers are arguing it's simply a new process, a simplified process, which is needed to curb the abuse of long procedures. I'm wondering if there isn't a middle ground here.
No, that's totally nonsense, Jeremy, actually, to say this will have some red tapes in the long process. In a normal working environment, any worker must be given an opportunity to actually defend himself in the hearing, present evidence, present everything, and then the employer must also argue in the hearing. So if there is no such a thing, employers like your farm workers, who are very actually precarious, they will just dismiss those farm workers. Your domestic workers, there will be no formal hearing. They will just be easily dismissed. So as the trade union, with the aim and objective to defend members, we can't allow such a right to erode easily in the interest of trying to have a middle ground.
Now, another one of your objections is that workers on probation could be dismissed without cause in the first 3 months. But doesn't existing law already allow more flexibility in that window? So explain to me what is actually changing in that respect.
Basically, on the probation, new workers who are entering into the market, will also be easily dismissed. There will be no any opportunity. The employers will just say, bye-bye, you are gone.
And then I want to take a look at the amendments which you say could legalize the firing or legalize firing of workers that bosses don't like under a term called incompatibility. But isn't that, Lebogang, something that already exists under current case law, and that would be subject to challenge, surely, at the CCMA?
Look, in terms of the law, there is what you call the draft code of dismissal. Anything, any dismissal must follow what the draft code actually saying. So with what now, this is a new proposal. Workers can now be easily fired, and for a small thing, for flirting and whatsoever, maybe the employer can say, you are not following the culture of the company, so you will be fired. What is the culture? That will be a question that I would even pose to you, Jeremy.
So let me ask you then, what are you calling for practically here? Is it a full withdrawal of all four amendment bills, or are there specific clauses that you're still, as a group, prepared to negotiate on?
Okay, we're demanding that the whole process must restart, because remember, not only four federations that are at NEDLAC representing the millions and millions of workers. 76% of workers are outside the trade union. The process itself must actually be democratized, must actually allow even independent unions who are not affiliated to even those federations. That process must allow even organizations like your casual workers' advice to have some sort of an input. So we are demanding that because the law, actually, these amendments have not been passed as a law. They still have to go to Parliament and to be voted. We will also be writing to progressive political formations to say, don't vote for this attack on workers. So we demand that the process must be democratized, must be open, allow inclusivity of each and every organization that represent workers. It's not only unions also that are representing workers. You have your advice office centers who are also experiencing the exploitation of workers. They must also be given an opportunity to do some submission.
All right, and just very quickly in conclusion then, if these amendments pass, what is your next step? Would you consider legal action, mass mobilization? What would you do?
The first step, we're going to fight this in twofold, Jeremy. The legal battle and the political one. The political one will be mass mobilization. We will be going each and every factory, mobilizing workers to say, enough is enough, hands down, we are going to fight in the street. And then legally also, we're still looking about the legal avenue of challenging this matter. If comes to a push, take it to the highest court, which is the Constitutional Court, we'll have to. Yes.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Lebogang Panyeko, who's the national organizer for the South African Federation of Trade Unions.
At the end of November, Johannesburg will host the first G20 summit on African soil, and the world is watching. Mandates and Megaphones is a new MoneyWeb podcast hosted by me, Jeremy Maggs, unpacking the politics, promises, and the power plays behind this historic event. From debt diplomacy and climate justice to global trade tensions, infrastructure pressure, and who gets a seat at the table, I'm going to dig into the issues that really matter and the impact on business and the economy. Follow Mandates and Megaphones on MoneyWeb and wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by Standard Bank.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, artificial intelligence, I think, is no longer a buzzword. It really is becoming a bottom-line driver. And globally, manufacturers are seeing real gains from AI in productivity, delivery speed, and, I imagine, profit margins. Yet, South Africa is lagging when it comes to adoption. Just 15% of firms reporting significant returns, even as 81% expect profitability to rise. So is there anything that's holding us back? Is it cost? Is it data quality? Is it talent shortage. What are the culprits? Well, I want to talk now to Tamba Ndweni, who is PwC's Africa Industry Leader for Consumer and Industrial Products and Services. And a very warm welcome to you. And maybe let's start with the basics here. And that figure of 81% is interesting. 81% of South African manufacturers believe it's going to boost profit. 15% only seeing meaningful return right now. What's the issue here? Is the local manufacturing sector moving too cautiously?
Firstly, hello, Jeremy, and hello to your listeners. So you're right. I think caution is the right word. And as you can imagine, AI in itself is a concept which many people face with kind of, I'd say, trepidation, dipping their feet into the water. But when you start kind of looking forward to it and welcoming it, you do see its benefits, and hence we've seen those profit numbers shoot up, as you've said. Mm. However, the kind of key points to call out is it's also not a cheap process, right? So it does have high implementation costs. We in South Africa have to look at kind of the data quality with our legacy systems that we have. And if that data isn't fit for purpose, then it kind of makes the hurdle to implement AI quite challenging. And then lastly, if you look at our workforce and sometimes resistance to things like AI, because we want to create kind of human employment, some of these things are really holding us back at this point in time.
So let's pick up on skills then. Do you think we're doing enough to build a talent pipeline in artificial intelligence and data science to keep pace with what the industrial sector needs?
The short answer is not enough. The reason is if you go back to kind of the curriculum that we see at university and also the students and capabilities that we're bringing forward, the answer has to be no, not enough. And then even within the workforce, kind of the experienced individuals that we've got, and sometimes even up to the leadership team, we still have to see and are yet to see really strong AI kind of drivers at an exec level, including boards, etc., that are challenging management teams to say, why are we not investing in this AI skill pool? And obviously, if it's rare, then it obviously comes at a higher cost as well.
Well, let's talk a little further about that disconnect. You also suggest there's a mismatch possibly between the expectations of executives and what AI can realistically deliver in South Africa's operating environment. So where is that mismatch most profoundly experienced, do you think, and how do you bridge it?
So I think the mismatch lies in various components, right? One is, we need to understand that AI understanding and implementation is a journey. B, it must live in the strategy of the organization. So have we developed a strategy around how to incorporate AI? Can we even see that AI is fit for purpose for our manufacturing industry? And once we get to that whiteboard and putting those ideas on the board, then we can start kind of moving forward to say, okay, so what is next? The other thing is, I think it's important for us to look at corporates that have already gone through these initial stages, be it in Europe, the Far East, or even in the Americas, and kind of see what they're doing already. And if we can call it copy and paste that, then I think that will give us a bit of a, not a quantum leap, but a two-step fast forward into what's the next stage. Clearly, we've got to permeate this throughout the organization and really bring in comfort rather than fear about AI and its value to not just the workforce and the manufacturing industries, but also the benefit to customers.
But underpinning all of this, as you rightly suggest, is strategy. So where's the starting point in developing that strategy, and what would the critical touch points be?
I think the critical touch points would be looking at your processes as an organization. I think an industry like automotive has already done this very well, where you can understand that in a automotive plant, the amount and the kind of the heavy duty equipment that has to move through a plant is not only dangerous for the safety of employees, et cetera, but it's also repetitive. So if you look at those two components, you say, do we have big moving parts? Yes. How do we create safety in our organization? Introduce robotics and allow them to kind of do the work there. And then secondly, if a process is repetitive, then you can invest in kind of ensuring that your systems, as I said earlier, have the data quality that's required for them to be able to produce these products on a consistent basis. As a simple example, in that automotive industry currently, you can produce, instead of a linear 7 wide vehicles, etc., you can introduce different colors after in those seven vehicles, left hand drive, right hand drive, and those machines can, using AI, produce them exactly as fit for purpose, as spec out by the customer themselves.
And I guess underpinning all of this is trust when it comes to AI systems. And I'd suggest to you that there is still a trust deficit when most companies are still in an experimental phase. And that's going to take a bit of time, surely, to overcome.
That will take time to overcome. It's really the dipping in of the toes. The understanding that AI is here to stay, and it's not here to, it's not kind of moving away from us, is a reality that we have to face. And to be able to trust that it will work, I think we have to look at solutions that are already out there that will help us be less fearful, but again, more embracing of what AI can do for us. So definitely trust is kind of a hamstring in terms of what AI can do at this stage.
And just quickly, what are the real consequences of waiting too long?
Well, I guess if we look at South Africa in particular, there's kind of initial benefits that you can get. So think about something like predictive maintenance in a plant. You can get sensors that you can attach to your equipment and machinery, and that can kind of tell you when you need to maintain your plant. However, if you don't do that, then we live in the world that we are in now, where you want to have these long shutdowns, it's unproductive, you certainly have lots of downtime, et cetera, et cetera. So you really want to move away from that and see if you can find helpful solutions to kind of moving forward and getting your product quicker, better, faster out with high quality.
Well, certainly a glimpse into the future. Kaba Ndawini, thank you very much indeed. PwC Africa's industry leader for consumer and industrial products and services. I do appreciate your time today. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa, I understand, is quietly facing a fast-growing environmental and economic challenge, the explosion of electronic waste. From discarded cell phones and old televisions to broken laptops and household appliances, most of it ends up in landfills. That poses serious health risks and obviously environmental risks. At the same time, millions of young South Africans are unemployed and desperate for meaningful work. I wonder if there are dots to be joined in this respect. Ashley Duploy, who's Chief Executive Officer of the E-Waste Recycling Authority, says there's an urgent opportunity to tackle both problems at once by building, he says, a circular economy that could turn trash into jobs and waste into resources. So Ashley, a very warm welcome. Let's start with that problem then. How bad is South Africa's e-waste crisis? And one's got to ask why it's not getting the attention it maybe deserves.
Thank you, Jeremy. E-waste is growing at about four times the rate of solid municipal waste. And as we know, the country hasn't come to grips with dealing with municipal waste effectively. So you can imagine growing at four times the rate of solid municipal waste. There's a tsunami coming. It's a global phenomenon that electronics are being reinvented. New electronics are being produced all the time. And this is literally in about 20 years, if it's not properly controlled, will create mountains of electronic waste. So the opportunity is definitely there. The environmental impact is staring us in the face. If one looks at the solar sector, for example, solar panels, there are millions of coming onto the South African market, and they have a limited lifespan. So one can just look at different electronics and just see the escalation of that waste stream.
So Ashley, let's talk about opportunity in just a moment. But I guess for most of us, it's a bit of a mea culpa here. We just toss out old electronics. Maybe before we look at the opportunity, what actually happens to that waste? And what are the risks if it's not properly recycled?
The waste currently, or a large part of it, is being dismantled on the streets and being scavenged for the metal content, which is sold to scrap metal dealers, and the rest of the waste is left in our environment, in our landfills, in our streets and rivers. So that waste has, in the metal content and the rare earth minerals, those are required for the production of new electronics. But there are also huge numbers of problem fractions in electronics. I mean, you can look at any device and you can see it's a composite of many things. So these cables get burnt for the extraction of copper. Batteries, also besides having toxic materials in them, also can fire risk, lithium ion batteries. And those are also accelerating. The production and the use of that is accelerating at a phenomenal rate. So there is an economy that is waiting to be born in the proper treatment of electronic waste. And the first objective would always be and should be in a circular economy context to try and extend the lifespan of these electronic products, also to reduce the hazardous components that make up that electronic waste. So an organization like ERA recognizes that the value materials in electronic waste in a way will create its own economy, but our responsibility as producer responsibility organization is also to ensure that we treat the negative fractions in electronic waste properly.
Let's have a closer look then, if we can, at that circular economy model that you're talking about. What would it look like in practice?
Well, in practice, beginning with production, that producers will ensure that their materials that they use in their products are recyclable, or they use more recycled content. But when those electronics come to the end of life, there is scope for a repair and refurbishment economy or industries, whether it's for domestic appliances, reusing solar panels, finding a second life for them. So extending the lifespan and getting people trained and set up to repair waste electronics is one of the opportunities. And then also there is considerable scope for the manual dismantling of electronic waste. As I said, you know, the batteries are a hazard. You don't necessarily just want to shred them. I've seen operations recently where three stages in the dismantling line, people are looking for those batteries to extract them safely and process them safely.
So you're making a very strong case for the circular economy. I wonder then, what is stopping e-waste from becoming a job creation engine? Is it infrastructure? Is it policy support, funding, or I imagine probably a combination of all three?
Yeah, I think the policy environment has shifted in the right direction. There are now extended producer responsibility regulations that compel producers of electronic products to pay an advanced recycling fee, which is to be deployed in building a system and a network for managing electronic waste. So I think the other element is that awareness of electronic waste is pretty new, and ERA and other PROs have gone on massive information campaigns so that people's awareness around the opportunity risk in electronic waste grows. And then obviously we have to meet targets that government has set for the increased collection and recycling of electronic waste. And to meet those targets, there are significant new job opportunities because the volumes literally increase and the number of people required to process those volumes necessarily have to increase, whether it's in job creation or small enterprise development.
Ashley DePloy, I'm going to leave it there with my appreciation, Chief Executive Officer of the E-Waste Recycling Authority. Thank you so much. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.